Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 9th, 2007, and this is show number 111. Well, I'm going to apologize in advance because I have just the tail end of a summertime cold. I'm going to try really hard not to sniffle, but if I forget, I apologize in advance. Before we get too far along, I want to give a shout-out to Bart's office mate, Peter. You see, Peter gets to listen to the No Silicast because Bart plays it in the office. But Bart was on vacation last week, so poor Peter didn't have my dulcet tones as an entertainment for his day. Well, Peter, I'm glad Bart is back at work finally so you can get to hear the show. Do you remember ages ago on episode 84, I told you about the Mechanical Turk? It's a long story, so I won't repeat it, but the basic idea is that there are some things a computer simply can't do. So the way this thing works is people submit jobs to this website, to the Mechanical Turk, and then humans can work on these tasks and actually get paid small financial rewards for doing it. Really small, but if you do enough of these tasks, you could make money. The kind of things that are simple for us, like identifying whether it's a sign in a photo or not, that's completely impossible for computers, but trivial for us. So that's the kind of thing that people submit to the Mechanical Turk. Well, the Mechanical Turk at mturk.com is being engaged for a very worthy cause right now. You see, Stephen Fawcett, I don't know if it's Fawcett or Fawcett, anyway, he's an American aviator, sailor, and adventurer who's known for his appetite for setting world records. He's best known for his 5 world record nonstop circumnavigations of the Earth as a long-distance solo balloonist, as a sailor, and as a solo airplane pilot. Well, unfortunately, his plane disappeared over Nevada earlier this week, and he hasn't been heard of since the 6th of September, I think it is. His family and friends are asking that we all go to mturk.com and look at the satellite imagery that has been updated on Google Earth of the areas where he might be. Each of us can go out and scan for his plane. Using this tool is really easy to do. You just click on a link to download and install a KML file, which then updates your Google Earth imagery to make sure you have the latest, and it's on the specific area where he might be. Then, for each what they call hit, you copy and paste the coordinates into Google Earth and scan for what could look like a bright white plane. All you do is say, "Nothing here," or, "You know, I think I see something," and then you go on to the next one. By the way, there's no financial reward for this one. It's a bigger reward than that. If you're curious to see how the Mechanical Turk works, or if you're interested in aviation pioneers, or you have a soft heart, or even if you're just bored, check out the link in the show notes to the Mechanical Turk and help his family find resolution. It's possible by the time you hear this, he'll have been found. Let's hope so. So keep an eye on the news just in case. Thanks, everyone, for your time. I got a lovely fan letter from Melissa, who calls herself the Mac Mommy. She told me how much she liked the show and gave me some background on how much she likes the Mac. She's a Mac consultant and the mother of a 1-year-old. I don't know how, I didn't think it was possible to be physically possible to do both. She loves to teach, and she actually wrote up a great tutorial all about Picasa web albums for us here on the show. I'm going to read her letter to you as she sent it, so remember when I'm saying I, it's really Melissa talking. Don't get confused, I'll let you know when I'm back. Allison, have you used Picasa web albums with iPhoto? When I saw the info for this past podcast, I was excited because I thought you were going to talk about it for the Mac. I wanted to tell you what I like about Picasa for the Mac, just in case you haven't tried it out. I've been kind of surprised that no one seems to mention the ability to upload pictures to it from iPhoto, and I've just been waiting for someone to mention it in at least one of the podcasts I listen to, and so far no one has. There have been lots of talk about how Apple is more and more partnered with Google and YouTube, but it seems to me like Picasa is kind of overlooked. I just got iLife 08, so I haven't yet loaded it and gotten to use the new iPhoto, but from all the reviews, it sounds terrific. Perhaps this coming weekend, I'll have a chance when we go up to see the in-laws. Built-in babysitting so mommy can go geek out. So, I might have to get back to you and report on any changes, but for now, I'll assume that it will work. If you have a Gmail account, you can create a Picasa web album for free. This kind of thing is good for geek moms like me who are on a shoestring budget and can't afford a .Mac account. I love exploring freebies. First, go to picasa.google.com and get and install the Picasa Web Albums Exporter for iPhoto. Then just select the photos you would like to upload either from your album, now they're called events, and then go to the file menu and select export. A sheet will drop down where you enter your Gmail username and password. You can change the settings depending on what you'd like to upload to an existing album you've already created or make a new one. I included a screenshot of one of my albums from my son's first birthday party. Notice the captions. I was able to enter comments in iPhoto, and they show up as captions here in the album that are visible upon rollover. That's my favorite thing about this Picasa plugin, is it also exports the comments. That will be the main feature I'll be looking for in the new version of iPhoto. I used to use Yahoo for my free online photo posting service, and I love their drag-and-drop tool. But I always disliked the fact that you had to retype in all the comments in the pictures once they were uploaded. Picasa is much faster at uploading, too. I also like that in Picasa Web Albums, you can enter the date of the event and also the location of where the photos were taken, and it puts a little push pin on a Google map. This would come in really handy for people who travel on a long road trip across country. There are lots of other free photo hosting sites out there, but so many of my family members have complained with having to sign in or register to view them, such as Snapfish. And I like the fact that Picasa doesn't make you sign in. Plus, I have a Gmail account, and my homepage is my iGoogle page, and on one of the tabs of my iGoogle page, I made a Pictures tab, and a page that has a Picasa Web Albums gadget that shows you a random little slideshow from your albums. This is one of the many gadgets you can get. You can share it with your friends and family who have an iGoogle page, and they can install the gadget onto their page too. I guess it's like a virtual refrigerator magnet for your grandma. I hope you find this tidbit of information useful and might even want to share it with other listeners out there looking for a free alternative to .Mac account for sharing their pictures. Since I'm a new mom, I'm always snapping pics and taking movies of my son, and I like being able to share them with friends and family all over the world. All right, this is Allison back now. Wasn't that a great review? I do like how Melissa sticks to the NoSilicast theme of solving real problems, like how much we all hate having to log in to see someone else's photos. I know they think their new baby is worth any amount of work, but for some reason, I think if I'm going to have to go look at him, you better make it easy for me. Not that Melissa's baby might not be worth looking at. No, I didn't mean that. Well, before I forget, I should tell you that Melissa later on sent a note explaining that the Picasa web uploader for iPhoto is broken with the new iPhoto 08. You can still use their standalone uploader program, though, which is very quick and works beautifully, but it doesn't support the comments like the iPhoto plugin does. I'm sure Google will fix the uploader plugin for iPhoto soon. Thanks so much for listening to the show, Melissa, and for taking the time to write a great tooltip. I don't know how you did this with a one-year-old at home. I was lucky if I got my hair combed each day when I had kids that young. I hope you enjoyed my story last week about how I had to jumpstart Steve's car for him. I can tell you that Honda Bob enjoyed it a lot. Of course he was happy that my first instinct was to go to his website at hdabob.com because I knew I'd find instructions on how not to electrocute myself or destroy either car. But he also enjoyed the fact that I had to save Steve. He called this week and offered to alter Steve's car so that he would be able to charge small, low-power devices like his GPS unit without having to turn on the ignition in his car. This sure would be handy. I think the reason they don't have it this way in the first place is that you might think you could run an electric heater or a TV all night or something, which would definitely drain your battery. In our case, I think we can remember not to do that. I hope so, at least. I feel very confident knowing that I can always call Honda Bob for help with the cars. How many people can say that they have a mechanic that they really, truly trust? Most people live in fear of going to the dealer, knowing they'll get ripped off, but just hoping they won't have a car in worse shape after the repairs than before. The fact that Honda Bob comes to my house to do all my regular maintenance and the very few and far between repairs is just an added bonus. If you'd like to enjoy this peace of mind and have him come to your house, and you drive an Acura or Honda in the LA area, give Bob a call at 562-531-8000. 2321 or check out his website at hdabob.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. Well, my friend Chan was running out of disk space on his Parallels installation of Windows, and he asked me for some advice. I explained to him that there's a feature in Parallels called Compressor, and in telling him about it, I decided to run it again myself, which turned into a learning experience with the latest version of Parallels 3.0. First, this is a caution. Parallels Compressor only works if you're not using a bootcamp partition for your Windows installation. In the help files, they tell you how to run the compressor. The help files for Parallels are stored locally on your machine, but they're brought up in a browser. So I'm sure that if the link that I put in the show notes will work on your machine, I'm not sure it will, but I threw it in anyway if you want to read a more detailed explanation of how to do this. So the idea is that when you set up Parallels in the first place, Windows is, you tell it how big Windows is allowed to be, how big the biggest it's allowed to be. So let's say it starts at 4 gig, but you tell it it can go to 12 gig. Well, over time, Windows is just going to expand to fill the available space, and every once in a while you got to go back and just compact it back down, squish it back into less space, and you actually recover that space on your disk. So basically, you launch your virtual machine, which is probably Windows, but it can be different flavors of Linux as well, and then under Actions, pull down a Run Parallels Compressor. I decided to run it. I hadn't done it in a long time, so I could give you an idea of how much space I recovered. I started with 12.74 gigabytes taken up by the .hdd file that represents all of Windows XP, including applications and, you know, photos and documents and all that. So that file is the single file that represents all of that. When I went to launch Compressor, it said that I had snapshots running and that I had to turn them off to run Compressor. This was the learning curve part. I'd never heard of snapshots, but it turns out in the latest version of Parallels, they have the ability to capture snapshots of your operating system from time to time so you can revert back easily. This is obviously a cool feature, yet another example of how the Parallels team regularly updates their application to amaze me. Of course, I suppose if I read some documentation, I've known it was there, but you know me, not going to happen. So, in the menu bar, I selected Actions in Parallels and ran the Snapshot Manager. It showed that I had a July 2007 snapshot, so I told it to erase it. This took a very long time. I got bored and left after a while, so I'm not sure how long it took, but it was at least 10 minutes. Okay, I bore easily. Well, this seemed odd, because the snapshot file in my image folder was only about a half a gig, but I am glad I waited it out. I had kind of thought something was wrong with it and I was going to kill it, but running away made it finish. I then ran the Parallels Compressor, which runs while your virtual machine is running. When it was complete, it rebooted Windows and went into a check disk mode, which surprised me, but it booted up just fine after that. I then checked the size of the .hdd file, and it was down to 9.86 gigabytes, so I had reclaimed 3 gigabytes, or about 25% of my disk space. Remember, Windows will grow on its own until it fills up the size you declared up front for your virtual machine, so this isn't any kind of permanent fix. You have to run it every once in a while to reclaim your territory. Sure is nice to have another way to find disk space. One thing I should point out is that my friend Chan started with a disk that was a little over 9 gig, and when he was done running the compressor, it was still 9 gig. I started at 12 and ended up at 9 gig. So I don't know if 9 gig is some magic number or it's just a coincidence, but he didn't recover any space starting at 9. I have a Mac tip that I've been using for a long time, but I don't think I've ever heard anyone else mention it. So it's either a tip that has very little value to folks, or it's just a hidden gem that only I know about. We'll see the truth. If you're like me, you really like efficiency. Using keystrokes instead of moving the mouse is the best. You know, that kind of thing. Part of that keyboard efficiency is to use the keypad for numbers rather than hunting and pecking across the top of the keyboard. Well, what do you do if you're on a Mac laptop and you have no keypad? This is not a great solution, but up in the F keys, you're going to see a numlock on the F6 key. Turns out if you click F6, you might have to hold down the function key to engage the F keys, depending on your configuration. You're going to get some real treat here. Okay, You're all yawning right now because you know that on Windows, the NumLock key allows the keypad to work. Never did figure out why you'd want your keypad not to work, but what the heck. But remember, in this case, we don't have a keypad. This is where it gets really exciting. Look at the letter keys on the right side of your keyboard, say around J through I or U through P. If you're over 40, you may have to grab your glasses first, but then peer closely at those keys and you'll notice little numbers and symbols in the bottom right-hand corners of the keys. If you have the F6 key engaged, the letter keys turn into numbers and symbols. The reason this is cool is that they're almost configured like on a real keypad. On a real keypad, the numbers are in a 3x3 square grid, but on the keyboard, they're sort of in a parallelogram, so it's a little weird. But I still like it better than using those stupid keys across the top if I'm doing a lot of numbers one after another. The hardest part is to find the enter, plus, minus, and multiply, divide buttons. I don't want to destroy all the adventure for you, so I'll let you find those on your own. Okay, as I'm just trying to describe this to you, I'm realizing that perhaps this key won't thrill all of you. Again, maybe this is why nobody else talks about it, but I really find it nice when I'm doing a lot of numbers, like trying to balance my checkbook, which is a whole nother story about how long that takes me. It is important that I give you a serious warning here. Learn by my mistakes. The other day, I was doing my checkbook, then I got interrupted and I had to put my machine to sleep. When I got back a few hours later, I had to enter my password to wake it up. And my keyboard wasn't working right. Oh no, maybe the wine I poured in there this, 2 weeks ago has actually come back and it's ruining my keys. Some of the keys would make little dots of the password, but the other keys weren't doing anything at all. I panicked. Oh no! And then, of course, I remembered that I had that pesky NumLock key on. It's a tricky one. Be careful with this tip. Don't try this, you know, without a lot of supervision because you might frighten yourself too. My son Kyle has shown very little interest in my podcast. To my face, at least, I think behind my back he tells people about it. This week he came proudly in to talk to me, a rare thing for a teenage boy all by itself, and told me about a couple of cool keyboard tricks on the Mac, and then said, "You can talk about them on your podcast if you want." How could I resist that temptation? The first problem he wanted to solve was to find a way to get Firefox to open up with two or more home pages set to tabs that would open all at the same time. He asked me, but I didn't have a clue how to do that, but then he figured it out on his own. On Firefox, if you go to Preferences and hit the main tab, you could set the home page to be Current Page. Well, it turns out that if you first open the multiple pages and tabs that you'd like to have open each time you launch Firefox, and then open the Preferences, it now says use current pages instead of current page. Pretty cool. I put a picture in the show notes so you can see what he's talking about. His next tip was a way to flip between tabs in Firefox without using your mouse. This is something I definitely want to know about. You know how I like using keystrokes instead of the mouse. If it turns out, if you hold down Command Option and then use the left and right arrows, you'll just happily pop back and forth between the open tabs. I really like that one. Kyle's third tip isn't really useful. It's kind of cool anyway. Hitting the function keys for Expose is fun, right? Sometimes you're bored and you just like to flip it on and off to watch the window zooming in and out, right? Well, Kyle and I do. Anyway, Kyle figured out that if you hold down the Shift key and then hit the Expose buttons, they go really, really slowly. It's really cool if you have dual monitors and it's pulling from one monitor over to the other one. It goes really slow. It's really neat to watch. I know this doesn't solve a big problem or any problem at all, but it's strangely satisfying to play with. Check it out the next time you're bored in a meeting or when you should be studying. Listener Sam turned me on to a new video upload site called Vidler at vidler.com. I'm pretty happy with YouTube. But if I've learned anything at all by my time studying technology, it's that you have to keep your eyes open because you never know when something amazing is right around the corner. So, with that philosophy in mind, I decided to give Vidler a try. Like any respectable website, creation of your user account triggers a confirmation email to which you must respond. The email came almost instantly, and I was in. While I was waiting these 60 seconds for the email, they gave a list of reasons why you should sign up for Vidler. You can upload your videos and share them with your friends and family. There are no space limitations, and it's free. You can link to and blog specific moments of your video. You don't have to look at advertisements. You can upload directly with your webcam. There's no third-party software required. You can post videos to your blog using the dimensions you prefer, and your stuff is safe. No one can download your videos. The site is very clean and pleasing and is in the social networking vein. You can make your videos public, shared, or private, and the first three big areas are for your videos, your friends' videos, and everyone else's videos. I like that organization. That's the way we think, isn't it? On your profile page, you can also see your statistics, numbers of downloads on your videos, shared videos, and private videos, as well as comments received, comments made, friends, and favorite videos. Well, it's about time we stop talking about it and upload some video, don't you think? Well, the banner across the top includes not only upload, but record. I decided to see how recording worked. When you select record, it triggers the Adobe Flash Player settings, asking permission for Vidler.com to access your camera and microphone. Next, it asks you to select the quality settings for your video and give some advice on whether to pick low, medium, or high quality. Next, it shows your camera's view, which has controls atop of the screen showing the choices for audio, video, and quality. I hit the record button, recorded 20 seconds, and then hit playback. Unfortunately, while it recorded video, it didn't pick up my audio. I checked the settings in Vidler and also right-clicked on the application since it's a flash recorder and verified that my audio was set to a built-in mic. I also went to my system preferences and verified that my mic was hot and should be able to record. I almost gave up until I realized I had my sound turned off so I just couldn't hear it. So anyway, Vidler worked fine doing that. The next thing I tried to do was upload a video. I picked a 50 megabyte file, and while it was uploading, it offered to let me name and tag the photo. That's a point for Vidler over YouTube. With YouTube, you can't hit upload until you've answered all the questions describing the video. But Vidler lets you do it in parallel. I like that. Vidler also offered to send me an email when it's done, which was excellent. With YouTube, Steve and I sit there anxiously hitting reload, reload, reload on YouTube to find out when it's done. An email is a much better solution from the user satisfaction perspective, I think. It also shows you real-time progress on a percentage upload, followed by percentage encoded. So there's upload and then encoding. I really like to see that. You know, I like to watch the progress. Most excellent. I recorded a video of my screen with the resolution set to 1440 by 900 pixels, which was the 50 megabyte file. It took less than 5 minutes to execute the upload and encode process. Now is when the real fun of Vidler comes out. Vidler lets you add comments at specific points in the timeline of a video, and even tags along the way, too. It was a little clumsy to add them. While the big green plus symbol on the moving timeline was pretty obvious, when you slide that button from left to right, the movie doesn't actually advance, so it's hard to tell whether you're putting your comment at the exact right spot. You're able to embed videos you've created into your blog or website, but it's not altogether obvious how to do it. Luckily, I found it quickly in the help section. It turns out that clicking on the green plus button that's visible as the controller for the timeline. Once you figure that out, the options are pretty obvious. I embedded the video I uploaded into the show notes. I chose to make a video of the tip Kyle gave us on slowing down expose by holding down the shift key. I think you'll like it because it shows you that I keep way too many things open at the same time. I even closed some things beforehand that had, you know, people's email addresses showing and that sort of stuff. Well, I think this is an excellent tip, Sam. I really appreciate you sending this along. I think Vidler is pretty easy to use, and hate to say this, I kind of liked it better than YouTube for uploading videos. I like the fact that it sends me an email when it's done. I like that I can record a video right there. That's kind of cool. The whole thing was very easy to use, pretty intuitive, and I will definitely use it again. Well, here's a tip that doesn't solve any problems at all, but it's kind of happy-making. If you use a Mac, There's a sound song that is associated with joy. And listener Leo sent in instructions on how to hear it whenever you want to. In the show notes, I included the path on your Mac hard disk in which this happy sound is already located. You can dig through folder by folder in the Finder to get there, 9 levels deep, or you can click on Go in the Finder, pull down to Go to Folder, and paste the path I put in the show notes into the field there and hit Go. Once you get down in there, you're going to find a file called intro-sound.mp3, and you should double-click it. Here's what you'll hear. Well, this is a happy sounding song because we all associate it with a brand spanking new Macintosh. What can be better than that? Thanks, Leo. I enjoyed that. I got a hot tip from Neil this week. It's called All My Faves from allmyfaves.com. This one's kind of hard to describe, but imagine one single web page where you could see the linked logos for every major website, in rows by why you'd care. There's a row of icons for news, one for sports, weather, wikis, banks, magazines. The rows go on and on. Each of these logos is clickable, so they link to the real sites. And that's just the homepage. There are tabs for entertainment, kids, shopping, and travel. Some tabs even have subcategories, like shopping gives you pages for apparel, home and electronics, And I forget what the third one is. It's really hard to explain how amazing this is, but this is cool enough, I might even make it my homepage. Of course, it also has Google in the top right, so you still have that right at your fingertips. Just go take a look and prepare to be surprised at how cool this is. I clicked on the tab for weekly faves, and I found tons of sites I'd never even seen before, so it helped me start experimenting with new sites. I do have to admit I spent a bunch of time on the kids page, which is available all by itself at kids.allmyfaves.com. I lost a half hour alone on the Crayola home coloring page. Well, thanks, Neil, for a really inventive tip. That was a lot of fun. I reviewed a product called Juiced a long time ago, and I wasn't very thrilled with it at the time. Juiced is an online video / TV show / sports piece of software. It's supposed to allow you to watch these shows, and they're paid for content, and it's supposed to be this formal way of, I don't know, watching TV on your computer. Well, this week I got an email from the Juiced folks, and it had the perfect hook to get me to try it again. They have licensed a bunch of vintage TV shows from the 1970s, like one of my all-time favorites, Welcome Back, Cotter, with Gabe Kaplan and a very young John Travolta as Vinnie Barbarino. I used to love that show. So I went out and I re-downloaded Juiced and went happily into Comedy to find it. The search worked perfectly, and I was able to choose the pilot episode. It was wonderful. I was really enjoying it. And then suddenly the screen went black. This went on for maybe about 15 seconds, and I figured, oh man, it's buffering again, which was one of the things I hated about Juiced before. But guess what? It wasn't buffering. It was gearing up to deliver a commercial. Well, it's not bad enough that they stick commercials in the first place, but to give me dead space for that long first? Okay, finally it started back up again, but it did it 2 more times before the half-hour TV show was over. I mean, 30 minutes and I had 3 commercials on it. It was awful. The black screen wasn't quite as long the second 2 times, but it was still a really annoying way they did this. The other thing is that the commercials break into the sentence. They just like chop right in. They're not timed to coincide with the obvious scene breaks designed for commercials, or heck, even to wait for the end of a joke. A bunch of jokes were cut off midstream, and you know, you gotta wait for that laugh track to come in. Oh, and on the second episode I watched, they played the same commercial 3 times. One other thing is very annoying, and perhaps if I actually read the instructions as a way to stop it from doing this, but the whole Juiced experience is driven by controllers on the top, bottom, right, and left sides of the screen, and they sit there blocking the screen at all times. The main controller is taking up about the bottom third of the screen with play, fast forward, and all that, plus a bunch of buttons I was afraid to push because I pushed one of them and it turned the whole program off, which I didn't want to do. The weirdest thing is that sometimes if you slide your cursor into a corner, all these annoyances fade away, which is what you'd expect, but sometimes they just don't. They just sit there, taking up all this screen space. I put a picture in the show notes so you could see exactly how much of my screen was covered with glop. Well, partway through the show, they popped up a sixth thing. It was the option to complete a survey on my Juiced experience to help them with the beta. I don't mind giving feedback. In fact, I enjoy it. But right in the middle of my show? How about waiting till I finish an episode? Man, maybe I really do need to go back and give them a piece of my mind. I tried using Juiced a couple more times throughout the week and thinking I'd get used to it, but I just found myself continuously aggravated by how hard it was to use, how it would repeat. Oh, one of the things, this made me crazy. I watched an episode, and when it finished, it started up the same episode again. Why would you not go on to the next episode of the same show if you insisted on playing something? Well, I found I was just fighting with the interface the whole time. I went back to iTunes and I put on a nice video podcast of the Cranky Geeks and I felt a certain peacefulness come over me because I wasn't fighting with it. Like I said, it was fun to see an old show that I really enjoyed, and I don't mind tasteful, short commercials, but their implementation along with all the screen interruptions is pretty annoying. The beta now allows people to invite others to join, so if anyone wants an invite, just shoot me an email at allison@podfeet.com. I'm sure after hearing my review, you're just dying to get in there. Speaking of invites, I do still have some Skitch invites left, so if you haven't gotten yours yet, let me know. Shoot me an email. Skitch is awesome. You should really take that one. Well, Leo sent me something very silly, but it really made me laugh. I'm sure you're all familiar with Jib Jab. They became famous when their silly video mocking our president and presidential candidates went viral a few years ago. Well, they've now got a new feature called Starring You, where you can make very silly videos starring your friends or yourself. Leo was kind enough to make one of me. I thought you'd enjoy it, so I put it in the show notes so you can watch how silly he made me look. I think he might be mocking me. Well, if you want to make your own videos mocking your friends and family, head on over to jibjab.com and click on Starring You on the left-hand side and have some fun. Did you notice how much of the show this week was listener-donated content? This is perfect. My goal is to someday do no work at all. I'm just going to read and play contributions from all of you and take all the credit. So keep up the good work. Send in your tips and ideas to allison@podfeet.com. Or if you got some time and the nerve, try an audio contribution by sending it to nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.